Okay, the court will now hear argument in Corney versus City of Englewood, appellate number 25-2683. Counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Cameron Pritchett on behalf of appellant Daniel Kearney. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
May it please the court. Daniel Kearney is a street preacher who devotes much of his life to spreading the gospel.
We know the facts.
Yes.
Maybe we can get to your argument.
Your Honor, here there are two errors that independently warrant reversal. First, the district court placed the burden on Mr. Kearney as the plaintiff to disprove defendant's invocation of qualified immunity. Second, the district court prematurely granted defendant's motion to dismiss without allowing even an ounce of discovery. Just 6 weeks before the district court's decision, this court decided Stringer v. County Bucks, which controls both issues raised in this appeal. First, as to burden, Stringer makes clear that as an affirmative defense, qualified immunity must be pled and proven by the defendant who invokes it. Second, as to timing, Stringer reiterates that a motion to dismiss is generally the inappropriate time to resolve a qualified immunity defense.
Let's emphasize the word generally. That means it's not prohibited. It's just generally not the method we adopt, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense must appear on the face of the complaint.
Let's talk a little bit about that first point you raised about the a burden to satisfy the two elements of the qualified immunity defense. You would agree that the district court did ably identify different cases in our precedent that articulates the burden in different ways. Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, the district court cited a couple of cases and for this proposition that there's an intra-circuit split, but it did not cite the primary cases that would be, if there were a circuit, intra-circuit split, on our side of it.
Well,
including,
let's talk about what is our rule. And the rule in this circuit is if there is a deviation of perspectives on a legal point, our precedent says the case that was decided first governs. So based on your research, when was the earliest case that you can identify that squarely put this burden on the elements of this qualified immunity defense on defendant?
Your Honor, first and foremost, we would disagree that there is an intra-circuit split. We believe that there's no holding that defendants or the court cite that would state the burden would be on the plaintiff. In fact, in the Halsey case, this court actually rejected the framework taken by other courts. And so the Third Circuit places the burden on the defendant.
But you would agree there are cases that seem to suggest the plaintiff has the burden. Whether that's right or wrong, there's some case out there that says it, correct?
We would disagree that there's a holding of any case, Your Honor. We would admit that there is some dictum, some loose language in a few cases like Erda, for example, but those cases are plainly distinguishable.
Let me ask a question about that. Is the dicta there on the same prong of the qualified immunity analysis that's at issue here?
It depends on the case, Your Honor. In certain cases, the district court relied on, what the court found there is that the right is not clearly established. In certain instances, there was a lack of a constitutional violation. Dongaro would be an example of that in the Eighth Amendment context. Your Honor, Judge McKee, there's an opinion in George v. Raheel in the Fourth Amendment context where there's language on the constitutional prong. And then there's some language in a case like Lupina, which is on the clearly established prong, which found that based on the facts alleged, there's no clearly established right at this at that stage.
So let's assume a plaintiff brings a case. They have to identify the right that's been violated, am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for the qualified immunity defense to apply, there needs to be a showing it's not clearly established, that whatever that right is, correct?
So yes,
the dispute here is who's got to show it's not clearly established?
Correct? Yes, Your Honor. So an example, a good example of this would be Doe v. Grudy, where the court faults the officer, the defendants in that case, for not identifying any case law that would show what the clearly established right is. And we cite from pages 16 to 18 of our brief, 12 decisions from this court and a decision from every district court in this circuit that faithfully applies this rule that the burden is on the defendant.
So does it matter really in this case? We reviewed de novo, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, so even if the district court was wrong in its analysis on a de novo review, would you agree that there's a clearly established right to be arrested only if there's probable cause?
Your Honor, we would agree but we would assert that there is no probable cause in this case.
I know that. I'm only asking you articulated a right that was violated. And my understanding from your pleading is the right that was violated is your client was arrested without probable cause, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. We also have a retaliation claim.
I know that. I'm only talking about probable cause right now.
Yes.
Because the retaliation claim will fail if we find there's probable cause. So I'd like to focus on probable cause if you don't mind.
Yes, Your Honor.
So with respect to that, the law is clearly established that there's a right only to be arrested with probable cause.
Correct, Your Honor.
So we don't need to get into this debate here about whether the right was clearly established. So is our focus then whether the facts demonstrate that right was violated?
Your Honor, you're correct. You do not need to reach the issue of burden. In this case, there are numerous factual questions outstanding about whether there was a reasonable assessment of probable cause in this case.
Who would they pled? Because my concern here is I'm not sure that the complaint pled enough to get you past prong one. And maybe you can correct
actually,
me
I thought that's why our colleague Judge Krause recently found it to be concerning to address qualified immunity at the motion to dismiss stage for that very reason, that it's almost impossible for the plaintiff to know how to plead the contours of the right before the defendant tells us what they think the clearly established right is.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. Is what Stringer tells us is that the clearly established inquiry is highly fact specific. Therefore, it'll be an unusual case where there are enough facts put in the complaint.
But again, that gets back to Judge Schwartz's question. We only get to that if you've alleged enough to get you past prong one. Then we can get into that. And it does seem to be clearly, we haven't discussed the case, but it does seem to be as to prong two, there's a real problem taking an affirmative defense and telling the plaintiff you've got to plead affirmative defense when you haven't even had discovery yet. So how can you possibly get into whether or not it's a clearly established right when you haven't had a chance to find out exactly what they did? I'm not sure that it can make any sense. But in terms of the first prong, that's my concern, that there are conclusions of law stated as to the first prong. But what are the facts of the complaint that would suggest that there was a violation of your constitutional right? And this is free speech, as I understand it, not religion, which is also under the First Amendment, obviously, but your client is arguing a violation of his free speech.
Yes, Your Honor. So at A39 to 40, the retaliation point, Mr. Kearney alleges that the officers specifically targeted him because of his speech.
Where in the complaint are we talking about?
This is at A39 of the record.
Yeah, I thought the claim was that he was protesting and he was then thrown in jail for 6 days. So
yes.
Those are the facts establishing the First Amendment violation. He's protesting, thrown in jail for 6 days.
Yes, Your Honor. And in addition, he was specifically retaliated against because of that speech.
It's the affidavit you're relying upon. But you're saying that the affidavit was false and you attached the affidavit to the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. So that was to retaliation to the false arrest.
Okay.
We allege a lack of probable cause for a few key reasons. One is what Your Honor just stated. The officers misstated to a judicial officer that they lied to a judicial officer, stating that Mr. Kearney was in violation of a court order and that he could be heard from the location.
Okay, let's take that. In terms of the lying, which would certainly get you to the malicious prosecution, where in the complaint do you state that?
Your Honor, that is at A42, paragraph 28 of the complaint. Mr. Kearney says the criminal complaint was false and that it alleges because his plaintiff was at the location and engaging in a protest that he violated the order of Judge Galena.
Okay, but falsity is not enough. You've got to show that it's an intentional falsity or reckless.
Your Honor,
doesn't get you over the hump, does it?
We would disagree, Your Honor. We think under cases like Pinckney and Scully.
You're saying just because the complaint, the affidavit was incorrect, that's enough to get you false arrest?
Your Honor, the complaint with the officers intentionally stated to a judicial officer.
Intentional.
Yes,
that's what we're talking. We're in here, you allege, that it's an intentional misstatement or a reckless mistake.
Your Honor, on A43, Mr. Kearney states that Defendant Moreno knew or should have known that his affidavit was false and instead arrested the plaintiff, Kearney.
Okay.
How was it false? That's a conclusion. How was it false? Because the only material we have in front of us is the complaint itself and the attachment of the affidavit probable cause. Tell me where in your complaint there's a falsity. Because to say it's false to say he knew he wasn't in violation of a court order, that's a legal conclusion. That's not a fact. So what facts have you identified in the complaint to demonstrate the falsity?
Your Honor, what Mr. Kearney alleges is that he was in compliance with Judge Galena's order.
That's a legal conclusion. That's not a fact. That's a legal conclusion, whether he's in compliance
or
not.
And that wouldn't be enough to get you past
it. See, that doesn't get you past it. And I think maybe that's what
it is.
We're probing on this point.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, there are numerous fact questions that simply have not been addressed, including could Mr. Kearney be heard from the location where he was present, whether Dr. Gresham even knew
But there is an allegation in the pleadings in front of us, the materials we can consider, that the officer said he could be heard from the location in which the victim, with whom he had the no contact order, was located. So we have that fact.
Including the officer went in. I don't know if he talked to the doctor, but he went inside to the location, which I assume was the location where, if the doctor could have heard it, he would have heard it in the location where the officer was standing. That's in the complaint, isn't it? Not in the complaint, the affidavit.
Your Honor, if you look at Judge Galena's order, what it states is that Mr. Kearney has the right to be present at that location.
Yeah, no, he didn't. No problem. We get that.
Yes.
He has a right to be there. He has a right to, it seems to me anyhow, he has a right to do what he was doing.
Yes, Your Honor.
But all that means is that it may mean the officer blew it and made a mistake. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was an intentional or malicious filing of an erroneous false, as you say here, that the affidavit was false. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was intentionally or recklessly false.
Your Honor, an important point in terms of timing is that affidavit was after the arrest of Mr. Kearney. The officers arrived at the scene with the knowledge, Mr. Kearney alleges, of his history of protesting in this sensitive place and preaching a message that some might find offensive. The officers then arrested him after going to the facility and just finding that Dr. Gresham was present there.
Well, they did not know that, and they said they could hear the communications, and under New Jersey state law, you can't send a message to somebody who you have a no contact order against.
But Your Honor, this was in contact order pertaining to a particular person, Dr. Gresham. So it's not clear that Dr. Gresham even knew Mr. Kearney was present or that he could be heard. This was a protest of a number of individuals. It's unclear.
Yeah, I think that's all well taken, and you think you're right about that. But I thought there was enough in the affidavit where the officer alleged, and correct me if I'm wrong, I could be wrong about this, the officer alleged that he went into the doctor's office, and from where he was standing in the doctor's office, he could have heard the statements, or he did hear your client's statements outside. Doesn't mean that the arrest was proper. I'm not saying the arrest was proper. It's a totally different question.
And I'll just, for the benefit of the record, at A66, the doctor was on site. This is the office speaking, noted that the protest could be heard from the doctor's office inside the location.
Can I ask a question about this, though? Because I'm wondering whose burden, again, here, since we're dealing with burden. So because we're talking about the officer figuring out that the doctor could hear. But if we're talking about probable cause to make an arrest, is it your position the officer would have had to have probable cause that Mr. Kearney knew the doctor was in? Because if an element of the offense is to contact the doctor who's inside, there'd have to be probable cause that Mr. Kearney knew he was inside. Had he entered the facility that day or seen the doctor that day?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. There's no evidence that Mr. Kearney entered the facility, that he made direct or indirect contact with Dr. Gresham. The facts would show in discovery that Mr. Kearney doesn't actually know Dr. Gresham, does not know him personally, has never met him.
Yeah, but his state of mind is not relevant for whether an objective officer's conduct was protected by qualified immunity. No disrespect to your client, but that the framework is the objective officer's state of mind, not what the individual knew.
But if the order that's being violated is contact, doesn't there have to be some intent to could you tell us what intent to contact, what does that mean? Like, what would he have had to do to violate the order?
Yes, Your Honor, under the two charges that were leveled in this case, McCurry would have purposefully or knowingly either stalked Dr. Gresham or violated a court order. And so the intent is relevant in terms of the ultimate assessment. But to your question, Judge Schwartz and Judge McKee earlier, what the officers alleged in the affidavit is that the protest could be heard. They do not state that Mr. Kearney individually could be heard. And as a matter of common sense, given that there are a number of individuals at this protest,
is there an allegation of how many people were present in the complaint?
No, Your Honor, that's not in the
record. The only thing that we know is what the officers relayed in their affidavit, that the doctor in this case is from the criminal point of view, was the defendant's outside, and the order prohibited direct, indirect contact. And the other facts that they alleged was that he knew from prior occasions that that doctor worked at that location, and he was there for a purpose to communicate a message about the activities at that location. Why is that not sufficient for an objectively reasonable officer to believe the order was violated?
Your Honor, that ultimately could be the determination at summary judgment, but because we're bound by the allegations in the complaint.
And I haven't decided what that's all I got is the complaint.
Yes.
And doesn't that alone fit into that category of in Stringer that says there could be cases that could resolve on a motion to dismiss?
Your Honor, we disagree that it's plain from the base of the complaint. Again, Stringer makes clear that would be an outlier situation. We cite Joanna Schwartz's law review article, which explains that summary judgment is usually the time when this is resolved. Motion to dismiss is very rarely the appropriate time to do this. But looking at the facts here, Judge Schwartz, it is unclear that Mr. Kearney could be heard from the protest. There should be facts gathered about the officer's knowledge about his history of protesting in this location. As far as our retaliation claim, we would like to develop comparator evidence under Nieves and Trevino to show that he was treated in a uniquely bad fashion, including construing a box cutter that he used to open up a box of Bibles.
Is that what it was? Is that the penknife that he was charged with?
Your Honor, they construed it as a weapon, as a knife. It was actually, facts would show in discovery, it was a box cutter he uses to open up a box of Bibles. He was
charged with having a knife with a blade, I don't know what the millimeter, basically 3 inches. A box, I've never seen a box cutter with a blade of 3 inches. This is beside the point because there was no true bill was returned on that. He wasn't indicted, but it struck me as bizarre. Frankly, it made me think that the officers were out to get this guy. Why would you arrest somebody for having a pocket knife in their pocket?
Yes, Your Honor, there are a number of facts that demonstrate that there is retaliatory motive here. The history that they had used other ordinances and statutes to target him specifically, that—
Okay, now where is that in the complaint?
That's at the beginning of his complaint, A39, Your Honor.
In the paragraph?
I'm sorry, A40 to 41, Your Honor. The officers had charged him with a number of offenses, including crimes and ordinances, and have done so with the intent—
What paragraph are you reading from?
Paragraph 24, Your Honor. Starts on A40 and then continues on A41. And what Mr. Kearney explains is that this is not an isolated incident. There was a history between these defendants and Mr.
That's
Kearney.
That's not in the complaint, though. I didn't see anything in the complaint that says there's some history between them.
Your Honor, this description, and we're entitled to inferences in our favor at this stage.
I'm happy to draw the inference. Just tell me what allegation would support an inference that this was a pattern of retaliatory conduct.
Your Honor, in paragraph 24, Mr. Kearney asserts that the defendants, members of the police department, know plaintiff and have interacted with him on a number of occasions. They are aware of his claims of his right to protest and street preach. Mm-hmm. Continuing on A41. Members of the police department have confronted plaintiff, challenged his rights and his message, including but not limited to charging him with a number of offenses, including crimes and ordinances, and done so with the intent to prevent him from street preaching.
But the only episode of charging is the complaint at issue in this case, the criminal complaint. We don't have other charges against him.
That is not in the record, Your Honor, those specific charges. Mm-hmm.
The only matter we have in front of us is this complaint, this criminal action.
In addition to the complaint itself, Your Honor, in this case, which asserts that there are other offenses.
My question to you is there anything in front that says that he's been charged on other occasions besides the instant episode that occurred in 2021?
Your Honor, when it's in paragraph 24, with a charge with a number of offenses, including crimes and ordinances.
You're talking about the crimes out of this complaint. Correct.
No, Your Honor, what Mr. Kearney is referring to not just the charges in this case, but that pattern, that history predating this.
There were other charges besides this one. And I'm not talking about the charge. We do know that he was the subject of some kind of no contact order. Complaints doesn't tell us the circumstances. It's silent. We just know there's an order.
Yes.
We know that he was arrested in 2021, among other things, for violating that order. Is it your representation that this paragraph 24, is conveying to us he was charged on other occasions?
Your Honor, this is beyond the record. I cannot represent to you.
You just told me to draw an inference. Yeah. I'm happy to draw an inference.
Yes.
Are you asking me to draw an inference from that language that besides the conduct that led to the no contact and the 2021 event, that there were other times he was charged by these defendants? Are you asking me to draw that inference or by this police department?
Your Honor, there's not enough information to know if there was an actual criminal charge brought against him. What I can represent is these officers have come to this location and threatened Mr. Kearney with violations of various orders or ordinances. So I know that there was actual criminal.
It doesn't help you because it doesn't get to whether or not the officer's conduct was retaliated. They may have in good faith thought that there was a violation of the ordinance going on. What I'm troubled with, and I think maybe Judge Schwartz is, if the complaint were alleging what I'm gathering from your argument, there's this bad blood between these officers and this guy, and this was their opportunity, they thought they could get him, they seized on that opportunity to bring a nonsensical or a reckless or erroneous, intentionally erroneous, charges against him in violation of his freedom of speech. If that were in the complaint, then we get to the second prong, the burden of proof on similar cases. I'm just not sure. I want to help get there. I can't get there right now. If, and I think this is what George is asking you, if paragraph 24 were basically saying there have been prior instances when you say a number of offenses, including crimes and ordinances that have to do with the intent to prevent him from street preaching, I don't know if we're talking about this case or there's a history of cases where they've done this to him. And those are two very, very different things.
Your Honor, even if you disagree with us on the retaliation claim, we still have our false...
No, I don't agree or disagree with you. I'm trying to get at what the retaliation claim is alleging.
Yes. Your Honor, throughout the complaint, Mr. Kearney explains that the purpose of him charged on this day was to prevent him from exercising his First Amendment rights. That's what the officer's intent was. When he says they had knowledge about Judge Galena's order, what Mr. Kearney is asserting is that they knew he had the right to be present at that location at that time. Again, Mr. Kearney did not even oppose Judge Galena's order because he was told directly, you can continue to preach this message at that location. So given that knowledge of the officers, the fact that they arrested him for being in violation of a court order would demonstrate retaliation and would also demonstrate a lack of probable cause.
Do you agree that as a matter of law, that if there is probable cause to conclude that there was a violation of the order or law, the retaliation claim cannot succeed? Do you agree that that's the state of the law?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Nieves, if there were actually probable cause, that would be true. But we allege for multiple reasons a lack of probable cause.
I understand your argument. And Judge Mascot, questions? Okay, Judge McKee. Mm-hmm. Okay, counsel, I'll have you back on rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Donald Klein, and I represent the remaining defendants in this appeal, who are Officer Colloran and Detective Moreno. I think there's a couple of general points I want to make, because with respect to the record, and I've been involved in this case from the beginning. There have been a series of motions to dismiss in this case. This complaint originally started with all kinds of general allegations about 8 different defendants. We moved to dismiss that. Judge Vasquez said, you better clean up, think, because it's all conclusory and whatever. And he castigated counsel for referring to the arrest order in his complaint without attaching it. And to this day, they refuse to attach it to their complaint. It finally wound up in the appendix. And I think it's important to understand what the facts were on that particular day. It's not just the complaint you look at in this context. You also look at the 4 documents that the court can consider under well-established Third Circuit law in determining whether or not it states a claim.
And that would be the order, the no contact order. It would be the affidavit of probable cause that was presented to the state court judge.
It also is what was attached, which includes the hearing before Judge Galena when he entered his no victim contact order and why he entered it.
And what about the jail time for the charges that ultimately were not charges?
I'm sorry.
There was also jail time, though, for charges that all based on the arrest that ultimately didn't even result really in prosecution, terms of the full context.
Well, that's even a more interesting issue. I've heard about this order for 3 years. It's never been produced.
What order are you referring to? Judge Mascot's asking you about the fact that as a result of these allegations that were never proven, an individual spent 6 days in custody.
Yeah, the release order they're talking about is something that they kept on talking about in their briefs.
Yeah,
we requested it. They never produced it.
You said a release order.
Pardon me?
You said a release order.
Correct.
Okay. What release order?
The release order was the A-174. I'm sorry, no. The release order was on page 174 of the appendix. It's a release order. That was the order that ordered the defendant, in this case, Mr. Corney, to be released on his own recognizance along with a no victim contact order.
So that order predates the episode here. Judge Mascott was out talking to you about custody that followed the episodes in 2021.
Right. No, I understand that. That's an order that he referred to by a different judge, which has never been produced. There's been bare allegations about it. And frankly, it wouldn't make a difference because what you have to do is you have to assess probable cause at the time of the incident. And that's exactly what happened here. It wasn't a situation where the order came after the fact. What happened is there was a call,
I'm trying to keep trying to keep up with you. When you say the order, are you talking about the release order?
Yes.
174 case, the pretrial release order. I have it in front of me.
Right.
I'm not sure how it has any relevance to what we're talking about today. It's what let him get out on bond. It's an unsecured appearance bond.
No, it's dated. It's when he was released. When it, in connection with what happened in March 27th.
Yeah, why is it relevant?
Pardon
me? Why is it relevant? Because if there was a violation of his First Amendment rights that had already occurred before the release order was entered, I'm assuming he was in custody. This is the release order to get him out of custody for the 6 days he spent in custody pursuant to the arrest that he's alleging was malicious. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the one that is the core of the case. This is the one where the judge said in releasing him after the incident that led to this order back in March. And just to understand.
Let me just help you out here.
Yeah, see, this okay.
So March 27, 2021, there's the no contact order.
Correct.
Then in August of 2021, there's the episode that led to the arrest that is being challenged for an absence of probable cause in the case in front of us.
Correct.
Okay.
And just to be clear, that original order was a no victim contact order. And in the context of the hearing transcript, it was very clear that the Judge Galina was saying to Corney, who was on the telephone, and actually consented to it, as a condition of it's a transcript, as a condition of the release until further order of the court, you're to have no contact with the alleged victim of this matter.
I don't think your adversary disputes that there's an order. I think his dispute is whether there was probable cause to believe that order was violated.
Right. And I respectfully, the claim that this was a false affidavit is something which, you know, it's purely conclusory. There's nothing to support it whatsoever.
So on that, so then is it your position that there should be further proceedings at a summary judgment stage to be able to adjudicate the conclusion?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because I think I want to get back to basic general principles in the Third Circuit, which are nowhere addressed in their papers. I mean, essentially, there's a law in New Jersey that makes it clear that these kinds of qualified immunity cases should be decided at the earliest possible time in the litigation. And it's true that generally they're done on summary judgment, but this is not that kind of a case. Mr. Corney had a 84 paragraph complaint laying out what were all conclusory allegations. He knew exactly what it is that was involved here. And the four documents that are to be considered on the motion makes it crystal clear what the situation was. Now, he does rely on, and I think the other...
No, finish that sentence.
What's that?
I was with you until you said, now he does rely on. Finish the sentence, you interrupted yourself.
Yeah, I was gonna say there are some other basic principles that we have to look at. You know, this is not a typical affirmative defense. I mean, the law in New Jersey has been for some time that qualified immunity is an immunity from suit rather than a mere defense to liability. That's the Mitchell versus Forsythe case. It's Hunter versus Bryant. I think some members of the court have even cited that in prior decisions. I think what we have to understand here is that in the context of the Harlow thing, bare allegations of malice, and that's the best you're going to find in what he's claiming in the complaint, should not suffice to subject government officials either to the cost of trial
or to the burdens of broad-reaching discovery. And the court went on to say government officials are shielded unless the violation of a clearly established statutory constitutional right of which a reasonable person would have known. Until this threshold immunity question is resolved, discovery should not be allowed. That's Harlow back in 1982.
And it's still a defense, whether it's a defense from suit or liability. Why should the plaintiff have to bear the burden of establishing those elements?
Well, in all of the cases we cited in our brief, and I'm not going to reiterate them here, all five of those cases put the burden on the plaintiff.
But aren't there other cases that put the burden on the defense?
Early, and I think...
And what, don't those cases predate those cases that were the burdens on the plaintiff?
Yes, Your Honor, but what they also predate is Connolly versus Gibson. I mean, they're based on a...
Connolly versus Gibson is not the law anymore. We're in Twombly.
That's my point. The difference was, under Connolly versus Gibson, which was, as you know, set to rest in the Iqbal case 15 or more years ago, the standard there was no standard at all. The test is set out in Connolly, and a lot of these cases come out of Connolly, or the case that they principally rely on, which cites Connolly, permitted district courts to dismiss a complaint for failure to set a claim only if it appeared beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set facts.
But that's not the law anymore, right?
No, and the law now is the flexible plausibility standard. You wouldn't have gotten motion to dismiss granted years ago under Connolly. You do get them now. There's been two, at least two that I would mention, where on a motion to dismiss, in a qualified immunity case, the court granted, and one of them, frankly, Judge McKee in the George case. And another one was the Asciano case in New Jersey. They're all in our brief. They're never addressed, but they're in our brief. And I think you also have to understand, and I didn't quite finish the historical thing I was saying about Judge Vasquez and how these things developed. The reason Judge Vasquez dismissed a lot of it and told them they had to remand is because it's too general. You can't just make policy arguments general. You can't make individual arguments generally. And gradually, you know, people just kept on getting knocked out of the case. The police department gets knocked out.
Right now, we do have two officers who are still in the case. And the issue before us is whether the district court was correct to say that on the face of the allegations in the complaint that exists today, those officers are entitled to qualified immunity.
Correct. But I think you're also entitled to look at the documents that
are integrally part of it. And we just discussed those, the order, the transcript that led to that no contact order, as well as the complaints that were filed following the episodes in August of 2021.
And the relevant case on that, it was almost identical to this, where the court granted a motion to dismiss where the attachments to the complaint contradicted the thesis of the complaint.
Well, here your position is read in their totality. The factual allegations would demonstrate there was probable cause for the arrest in this case. That is your position based upon the allegations.
Absolutely. Right? And I think
the adversary cites at paragraph 30 of his complaint that the allegations in the complaint was false.
Pardon me?
There's an allegation in the complaint at paragraph 30 that says that the complaint, these allegations by the officers in August of 21 were false.
That's just made up. I mean, there's no support for that. And also, there's a lot of confusion about how this happened.
Is there no support for it because they don't allege a fact, i.e. it's conclusory, or are you taking a position that the allegations in the criminal complaint are inconsistent with the allegations in the civil action?
I think I'm doing both. I'm saying they are conclusory, but they also, and you have to read the next paragraph in that complaint, because what they say is, and he's done all these other things and has been of course it was interfacing. It was interfacing that led to the original thing, the original hearing. The
next paragraph doesn't really say anything.
Pardon me?
Next paragraph doesn't really say anything. Just says it's been supposed to be taken through in court.
I think that the fact is the affidavit says in no uncertain terms that the officers knew that there was a no contact order out there from 6 months earlier. They went to the site They then confirmed that the doctor was on site and noted that the protest could be heard from his office inside of 40 Angle Street. And that's all you need in terms of violation. This was an any contact order. And we cited some cases that say just being in that vicinity is enough. And I mentioned one other case that they basically say, and I was involved in it, Judge McKee was involved in the on the same site, Turco, which was back some years ago. And there's all kinds of allegations in their complaint about contact neutrality and about all kinds of issues that were flatly resolved by Judge Wiginton 4 years ago, confirmed in a decision written by Judge McKee with respect to this site. And the one thing that was clear from that case, from the background in that case, is how tiny the site is. I mean, it's a little storefront, you know, in a two-story building, and you could hear, I mean, if there was a 200-foot order, there was no order, it was any contact, it was as close as you can be. I mean, you're right under the window, you're right next to them, you know? And the problem is that the view was that he was stalking him. And there had been prior situations that gave the police officers confidence that there was validity to it. They went there, then they went back and got the affidavit of probable cause. And then it got issued. And I do think there are some other questions that came up that I wanted to touch. We talked about Connolly, but I think if you give the value to what's said in the earlier cases in the Third Circuit with respect to qualified immunity, it's basically, if is any possibility avoiding discovery and putting government officials through what would otherwise be inappropriate, that you do it. And this is the perfect case for it, because you have a situation where you have all the allegations. It's not that he doesn't know what he's talking about. The constitutional right here, the right involved here, is whether or not somebody has a right to disobey a restraining order. That's the issue. The other claims, the freedom of speech, I mean, most of the stuff that they're saying about freedom, an absolute right to freedom of speech, they don't have a right, absolute right to freedom of speech at that very facility, as the court held in Turco. You know, we tried that case for 2 days, and it was a question, and the record is complete in that decision. I just don't think there's any question that they had probable cause, and that was enough. You don't even have to get to qualified immunity.
There's enough in the complaint to allege that they didn't have probable cause, and that's where at least I'm hung up there.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble. Yeah,
I'm hung up on whether or not there's enough to allege that they did not have probable cause, the first prong. And
that's a legal issue.
My concern. That's where I'm hung up.
Well, that would be a legal issue for them to allege.
I'm sorry, say it again.
No, that's a legal issue for this court to decide.
Yes, I know. I'm saying that's if he did that, he alleged that, it would be a legal issue.
But there have to be facts in there that would support that legal conclusion. But it's Rule 8 is notice pleading.
Yeah, but I think in terms, and I think the trial court said it, you know, quite succinctly and quite well when he said, in the context not only of a qualified privilege, but on probable cause, he said that. Just 1 second. He suggested in his opinion, indeed, the defendant's arrest decision may have been affirmatively lawful under New Jersey law. The plaintiff, after all, was present where the doctor was and interacted with him, though in a one-sided way that would seem to be enough to establish probable cause.
He's reading from the district court judge's opinion. Okay.
That's what the district court said. So I think the court can decide this, affirm it on either or both of those grounds.
Okay, see if Judge Mascott has any questions for counsel. Judge McKee? All right, counsel, thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just a few quick points in rebuttal. First, Your Honor, Schwartz, you asked about the first case we could find. Patzick v. O'Neill, 1978, on the burden, makes clear that the burden is on the defendant to plead proof qualified immunity.
And that also at common law, this is not unusual because at common law, the officers would need to establish the lack of probable cause.
Third Circuit, what year?
Third Circuit, 1978, Your Honor.
And
yep,
site?
Yes, Your Honor.
You got into the 80s, so good for you for getting to the 70s.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly predates me, but it's 577.
Don't be a show off. Go ahead. 577.
I can represent. It's 577 F second 841, Your Honor. And so,
thank you.
On the burden issue, Your Honor, it's also important to note that in this case, the burden erroneously being placed on Mr. Kearney was dispositive. At 821 of the record, even the district court says this is a close case as to whether there is contact, but here the burden is on the plaintiff. So this was dispositive in this case, and our position is that this court would need to overrule Stringer, Thomas, Reedy, Halsey, all of these cases that make very pellucidly clear the burden is on the defendant. Second, Your Honor, my friend mentioned cases that say that being in the general vicinity is enough. Those cases do not stand for that proposition. The case that the district court relied on, including DMG and JT, those cases are factually distinguishable. In those instances, in one instance, the defendant was recording the complainant. Another instance, the defendant was outside of the complainant's home and made eye contact and was staring at the person. We don't have anything of the sort here. Judge Galina's order defines indirect contact, social media messaging, email, third party intermediary. We have nothing of the sort. Mr. Kearney was present at the location.
But the case law from New Jersey does talk about communicating a message and conveying a message would violate the no contact provision, even though they understand what the Judge Galina said. But the case law, again, we have to do it from the perspective of a reasonable, objective officer. Would they understand that that behavior would be violative of a no contact order? That's the only point I wanted to make.
Yes,
I understand what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the proceedings today demonstrate there are a lot of factual questions to be answered here. It's simply premature to adjudicate on a motion to dismiss. We do not know whether Mr. Kearney individually could be heard apart from the protest generally. We don't know about the officer's history with Mr. Kearney, whether they knew he had the right to be present there, and if he was treated differently than others who were similarly situated. We also do not know if Dr. Gresham had...
That allegation, if it's there, I really missed it. But that would certainly help with prong one and your theory of the case. But I don't think that's there. Did you allege that he was singled out and treated differently than others who were similarly situated?
We did not say that directly, Your Honor, but that's a fair inference from the fact that the officers used a variety of tactics to intentionally thwart his First Amendment protected activity. Of course, at this stage, we're not required to plead around qualified immunity. We did not know qualified immunity would be raised, and so some of those facts are not in the complaint at this time, but discovery would show a number of instances in which Mr. Kearney was treated very differently than other individuals, and that was because of his First Amendment protected activity.
But under a notice pleading standard, if you could just one final time for us summarize like the complaint, where you think the strongest argument of a violation of constitutional rights is coming.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. We think that if I could give you a couple, Your Honor.
Sure.
So the first is that Mr. Kearney alleges specifically that the complaint in this case.
When you do that, help us with the paragraph number and the page.
Yes, absolutely. So just taking the false arrest first. Under a case like Voorhees, all we need to do is plausibly allege a lack of probable cause. There are numerous indications of no probable cause in this case. One is at paragraph 28, the criminal complaint was false in what it alleges about Mr. Kearney. Under cases like Pinckney, this court said officers cannot fake facts to substantiate probable cause. And so this mendacity in terms of securing the probable cause and then detaining him for 6 days demonstrates a lack of probable cause. Second, Your Honor, is the history that these defendants have with Mr. Kearney. Cases like Andrews v. Scully and Reedy, they say we must look at the objective officer with the knowledge that these officers have. And so paragraphs 24 through 25, where Mr. Kearney says he's been subject to a number of discriminatory acts by these defendants. That's paragraph 25. And then paragraph 24, we talked about earlier, that he had been confronted by these officers numerous times and challenged about the message that he was intent to preach. So under Andrews and Reedy, that knowledge the officers would have had is relevant for probable cause determination. And then third and finally, Your Honor, is that there was a finding in this case, of a lack of probable cause.
Yeah, but but the case law doesn't require us to defer to that.
Your Honor, it's irrelevant consideration, just in terms of...
We also have a finding of probable cause at the inception, right? So you have an unusual scenario of a criminal complaint where there was an affirmative finding of probable cause. It's by in the four corners of the document. And then subsequently, the Superior Court judge found an absence of probable cause. It's unclear the rationale, what the court considered or anything. So I don't know that I don't know that the fact helps either side. Because we're duty bound to look at whether it's an objectively reasonable standard. A reasonable officer under these facts would have concluded there was probable cause to believe a crime was committed and the defendant committed it.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with you in the general case, except that we have a specific allegation here that the probable cause determination relied on false statements made by the officer.
That's different than what you just said initially, which was a judicial finding of the presence or absence of probable cause. That's a different thing than an allegation by the party, a factual matter. The absence of probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor, except that the arrest here was made before that probable cause determination was made. And so the officer did not have that in their knowledge, that there was a finding of probable cause at the time they arrested him.
Afterwards, for your purposes, doesn't really help you or hurt you, because the sequence was there was a finding by a judicial officer of probable cause that confirmed, if your representation is, it was an arrest before the issuance of judicial process. After that conduct, there was an affirmation by a judicial officer of the existence of probable cause. Subsequently, in some kind of pretrial proceeding, there was a finding of an absence of probable cause. My point is, I don't think that really advances the argument, and it's certainly something that we're not to defer to.
But it also might lay bare how the burden of proof and who bears it here ultimately is going to be relative and outcome determinative. So we have to look closely at what the district court did there.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you could go on. So are you done? Because you did tell us at the beginning about the malicious statements when you were talking about how the complaint does allege a case. So assuming that my colleagues believe that the whole judicial finding thing is irrelevant, is there any other point that helps you affirmatively show the charges in the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. So those were the facts that pertain to lack of probable cause.
Okay.
In terms of retaliation claim, Mr. Kearney alleges plainly that the defendants were specifically targeted.
Where are you?
So on A39, paragraph 18, for example, Your Honor, defendants have obstructed and thwarted plaintiff's right to express his sincerely held religious beliefs. And then continuing on back to A40-41.
If there were a adverb there, that would be helpful. The fact that they've obstructed and thwarted his beliefs. I understand where you're saying you want us to draw an inference that was an intentional and malicious obstruction and thwarting of the religious beliefs.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can represent a number of facts that come out into discovery to substantiate and bolster these allegations.
Unfortunately, you have to just keep us on the complaint and reasonable inferences to be drawn from it and the integral documents.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor, and just looking at the complaint, Mr. Kearney explains he abided by the buffer zone requirements, that he was in compliance with any rules or regulations in terms of where he was allowed to protest, and that he did heed Judge Galena's order to avoid any sort of contact. Again, there's no statements, either complaint or otherwise, that the district court relied on. If you look at A18, the district court found that Mr. Kearney went to this location, to Dr. Gresham's place of work, and raised his voice loudly enough to be heard by Dr. Gresham. That is simply not alleged in this complaint. The district court accepted the defendant's allegations and rejected ours in the complaint, which is the opposite of how a 12b6 should be performed.
Any other questions?
Are there no further questions?
All right.
Respectfully ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you so much. No, there is no. It's only one side and one rebuttal. Counsel, thank you for your argument. We will take this matter under advisement. We thank you for your patience today and your excellent work. Thank you.
Thank you.